From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Lansing's history in welcoming refugees.
This is a place where you can really build a life, build a business, buy homes. These are people who really settle here and build roots.
Students from U of M guiding girls into the world of STEM.
I want to be that person for others who think, I don't even know what a scientist looks like. What do they do every day? And if I can reach even a single girl, that means that I'm doing something worthwhile.
A juvenile lifer's dilemma.
There is a tension that people don't understand between maintaining your innocence and trying to achieve your freedom.
And that MSU lost to Ohio State.
Whatever they do from here on in is gravy. They're not going to win the division, is my guess. But they have had one hell of a season, and that's just a write-off game.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 16 years into a life without parole sentence, Fred Williams maintains he is innocent. Now, as he awaits his resentencing hearing, this juvenile lifer faces a difficult and strategic legal choice. We'll continue our look at juvenile justice later in the hour. But first, one of the very best ways to help close the education gap for low-income kids is Head Start. Up to 36,000 children around our state and their families rely on Head Start for free early childhood education, for meals, support services for parents, and much more, funded by the federal government. But Chalkbeat Detroit reports 11 Head Start centers in southwest Detroit are shutting down by year's end. And that means some 420 children will have to be transferred to other centers, and 122 employees will be laid off. Just what happened? And are other Head Start centers in Michigan also on shaky ground? For the answer, we welcome Robin Bozick, Executive Director of the Michigan Head Start Association. Robin, what do you know about why these 11 centers in southwest Detroit are having to close?
Well, first of all, our first concern is with the families and the children who we know are being affected by this change. We also know it's never easy to have to make a transition anytime in the school year. But we are confident that these children will be resituated to another Head Start program and be able to continue. So what we do know is this. Head Start is a community program, and every community is different. Some programs are full this year with waiting lists, and then we have other programs that struggle with facilities, licensing, or other roadblocks. So it really does depend on the community. And while we have not spoken directly with the agency in regard to this, we know that the closing is not symptomatic of Head Start agency operations in general, that they have a situation there that mainly has to do with facilities issues, but there could be also financial issues.
I know Erin Einhorn's report in today's Detroit Free Press points to what she calls a complicated federal funding system for Head Start, requiring providers to match some of the funds, and also the challenge of finding and renovating classrooms that will meet state and federal regulations, and that it all got to be too much for Southwest Solutions. So what is so complicated about the federal funding system?
Sure. That is a common issue that we could say is shared throughout the state, and that is that we know that finding appropriate facilities is a struggle. But this issue of a lack of usable space is very real in Detroit, and I would say should not be minimized. One of the problems is that there are buildings that cannot be licensed because of heavy metals. But the bigger reality is that Head Start grants, as you said, can only fund operations. And that means that programs have to look outside of their grants to fund the capital improvements. And as we all know, it's very hard to get money to do construction or remodeling.
Ah, okay. So just so we're all clear, those federal dollars that come can educate kids, can provide the meals. So the services part is there, but the facilities, each agency has to do that on their own.
That is correct. And then there's also the issue in every community of building good relationships and working within the community to solve problems around the classroom space and all of that.
What's the takeaway, Robin, for you and the Head Start community in Michigan from what you're seeing with these 11 centers? I mean, could we see this happening elsewhere in Michigan because of these funding and facility problems?
I really feel that that is a more unique situation to Detroit and that we won't see other facilities closing. We're in constant contact with all of the different agencies, And we don't have others that are saying that is going to be an issue. But we are very concerned and truly sad for the children and the families involved that have to make a change for that. We do believe that those services are vital for those children and that the comprehensive services that they get through them, which help them, as you know, with their nutritional, their health, all of these different social-emotional pieces are critical. And without it, it would really be a loss for those children in Detroit.
It certainly comes across in Aaron Einhorn's piece in the Free Press how very attached the families become with everybody with Head Start, with having the services and with their teachers and the staff.
Yes, the parent and family engagement, I thought, was reflected in the article because of the way that these particular teachers are able to help these children. Many of the children that come from backgrounds that lack food and just security, they're receiving that at the school, and so that's really irreplaceable. The engagement with the families and the parents, that's critical now more than ever because of the increase in poverty that we've seen and the fact that many of our Head Starts are based in community action agencies where they provide a multitude of services that help the families move from poverty into jobs and that type of thing.
From where you sit, how would you grade the overall health of Head Start in Michigan?
I think that we are very solid, and I would grade us very highly. We are embedded in every town and city, and we work with our local community, so it's very reflective of the local communities. And we know that 1 in 4 of children are born into poverty in Michigan today, so we feel the need for Head Start is stronger than ever.
Robin Bozek is Executive Director of the Michigan Head Start Association. Robin, thanks so much for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Time to talk sports and say hello to Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubacon. And let's start out with the Lions, who struggled their way to a win over Cleveland. But boy, that was a mighty bad start over a team that hasn't won a game all season.
Yes, the mighty Browns are now 0-10, and they are threatening the only team that ever went 0-16. Of course, that's the Lions. So it's a game you got to win, and they did win it. And not at all flashy, but Golden Tate is back and looking good. The receiver, of course, that's vital. And the schedule sets up pretty well for the Lions the rest of the way in.
It does, okay, because we've got the Bears on Sunday.
Yeah, they got Bears twice, and the Bears are 3-7 right now. They're not very good.
And the Vikings on Thanksgiving.
The Vikings are very serious. That's the top team in the division right now, but you've already beaten them at Minnesota, and that is crucial. The Lions are 5-4 right now. That is the cusp of mediocrity.
Yes.
That's how the NFL is set up. So they're right in the hunt. They may not win the division, is my guess, but they will almost certainly get a wild card berth.
So. And as you've always said, they're a wild card team.
They're a wild card team, and they're right on target.
Over to Saturday's college action. What's your big takeaway from each of the games with the Spartans getting hammered by Ohio State and the Wolverines hammering Maryland?
Neither are a surprise. I think you and I were talking perhaps about this the previous week. Anybody Ohio State faced after getting crushed at Iowa. Iowa scores 55 points on Ohio State. Incredible. After getting crushed by those guys, I don't care if you're the Lions or the Patriots. I think the Buckeyes would have crushed you. And keep in mind right now, Michigan State has the three big teams in that division, Michigan, Penn State, and Ohio State. They have beaten 2 out of 3. Last year, they won 3 total games. So whatever they do from here on in is gravy. They're not going to win the division is my guess. But they have had one hell of a season, and that's just a write-off game.
And then here we've got Michigan 8-2. They're at Wisconsin next Saturday and host Ohio State then.
Harder, doesn't it?
Yeah, because actually when you think about it, Michigan State hosts Maryland next week and then wraps up the season at Rutgers.
They got 2 games they should win, and I think they're going to. They'll be 9-3 when they finish is my strong hunch there. Michigan's got 2 of the hardest games in the schedule, and we said that in August, of course. So Wisconsin at Wisconsin, they are undefeated right now. And the only Big Ten team, in my opinion, that really has a chance to get into the college football playoffs at this point. And, of course, Ohio State is Ohio State, and they are apparently ticked off. So 2 tough games. I bet Michigan splits them somehow.
Okay. And both teams have young quarterbacks still getting seasoned. What are you looking for from Brian Lewerke and Brandon Peters for the next season?
Lewerke has a lot more experience than, despite being the same age, basically, than Peters. He's a great runner, good judgment. I think he's going to become a very solid college. He already is a very solid college quarterback and going to become a better one. So that is one thing the Spartans are not worried about, in my opinion, going back next year. Peters is still largely unknown. He's been good, not great, against pretty bad team. So you're about to get a big answer on him this weekend.
Well, we certainly got it with Ohio State.
Exactly.
Welcome to Ohio State.
Tough opponents have a way of doing that, exactly.
And we should talk a bit about the news out of Tennessee about Brady Hoke. First year with the Volunteers and...
And as of yesterday, he is now the head coach of the Tennessee Volunteers. Interim, I grant you. Two games left in the schedule. One very tough, LSU at home. And then, of course, one relatively easy, Vanderbilt, as bad as basically Tennessee is. Here's what could happen. If they somehow pull the upset versus LSU, which often happens with an interim coach, because everyone's happy to have the pressure off them. Mm. Brady Hoke is a player's coach. Everyone likes the guy. If they beat them, they're going to beat Vanderbilt. If they do that, then it becomes possible for Hoke to become the head coach again. So.
Wow. So watch, keep your eye on that. And got to ask you, as we pivot over to the Pistons, 10-3 after the Pistons beat Miami on Sunday, second in the Eastern Conference. How surprised are you at this season, kind of the way it started for the Pistons?
A little surprised, but not that surprised. Stan Van Gundy, as you and I have discussed, is one heck of a coach. Always bet on the coach. You got a good coach, the team almost always gets there sooner or later. Now, it's early. Let's keep that in mind. You know, with hockey and yes. Baseball and basketball, I always say, until the All-Star break, who knows what's going on. But they're playing the best basketball the Pistons have played in years.
And I love his comment. Detroit Free Press writer Vince Ellis quoted Stan Van Gundy talking about the buzz, quote, "It scares the bleep out of me." He didn't want them focusing on that.
The beauty part of any head coach I've ever met who's any good is miserable because the only thing worse than losing is winning.
Because of all
now
the
you got
buzz.
Pressure, now you can blow it and all the rest. So that is a serious head coach right there.
I love it. Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank. And thanks, John.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll explore why the Lansing area is a landing spot for so many refugees.
Lansing welcomes about 600 refugees every single year into our community for the last 2 decades. So they have become part of the fabric of this community and really have built lives here and are just part of our city.
That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Collaborative. Experimentation.
The next idea.
We need a participation revolution, and we need it fast.
Today on The Next Idea, we're checking back in with a group we first met on this program back in 2014. FEMS, Females Excelling More in Math, Engineering, and Science, is a group of University of Michigan graduate students and faculty working to get girls in grades 4 through 6 excited about science and get them thinking about going into STEM fields. They do this through hands-on activities and presentations showing science in action.
My name's Areej. Today we're making some slime, the best part, and we were using ingredients.
Uh-huh. What ingredients?
Like glue and it's like the kind of soap.
First, we extracted the DNA from the strawberry. We had to smash them up.
Uh-huh.
Then we had to put a mixture of water, soap, and salt in there. Then we had to kind of stir it around, but not all the way where it'd be so soapy.
Sure. What's your name?
Michaela.
Like, of the stems, what's your favorite type?
Math.
Math.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool.
I'm really good at math.
That's awesome. Math is in everything, so you can take that anywhere you go.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest today is a PhD candidate in cell and molecular biology at the University of Michigan, part of FEMS, Hillary Miller. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited here to talk to you today.
Oh, this is great. I remember when we first learned about this group in 2014, I used to say, boy, do I wish you guys had been around when I was struggling with math and thinking I couldn't do it and let my science dream go. And this group, when we first heard about it, was pretty small. How has it changed since 2014?
Oh, well, we have grown immensely. We now have 29 full-time members who volunteer their time with us and their skill sets to reach an even broader audience of underserved girls in southeastern Michigan.
Now, are you aware, have there been any chapters at other universities that have popped up?
Yes. So, amazingly, we now have chapters at the University of Illinois and UNC Chapel Hill, and still at Duke University as well, where it was originally founded.
You know, it is interesting thinking about, I'm sure you have a lot of work to do on your own plate as a PhD candidate in biology, cell and molecular biology. That's just mind-boggling. Why is it worth it to you to take on extra work?
Oh, well, I find that this motivates me to do my work every day. It's incredible because someone reached out to me when I was younger and did the same thing, right? I have none of my family members are in STEM or computer science. And my mom had a family, we have a family friend who is a nurse practitioner. And she said, you seem to really like science. Why are you doing English? It doesn't seem to give you as much of a like pep in your step as science does. And I hadn't even considered that until someone gave me the idea.
Like opened up that window.
Yes, exactly. And I think that until you see someone doing, like until you have that person you can emulate and think about being yourself, it doesn't seem possible. And so I want to be that person for others who think, I don't even know what a scientist looks like. What do they do every day? And if I can reach even a single girl, that means that I'm doing something worthwhile.
Why focus on grades 4, 5, and 6? What's the significance of that?
Yes. Studies have found that 9 through 11-year-olds are the age that girls begin to lose enthusiasm in science and start falling behind academically to their male counterparts. And we believe that a bit of that is systemic society. And that is definitely changing, but that's mostly through the efforts, I would say, of females in the sciences reaching out to those girls.
Trying to say, look, I did it, you can too.
Yes.
So what kind of program might you offer? How does it all work?
Yeah, so we have capstone events twice a year where we have over 250 or around 250 girls who are either bussed in from the greater Detroit area or Ypsilanti, and they're in 4 activities that they usually choose. So we allow them to select whether they're interested in computer science, maybe chemistry, or if they've been to previous events, we try to always introduce them to new topics. And then they get to have these activities run by people who do these things every day. So chemists are teaching chemistry, computer science majors are teaching computer science, and they're doing it in really fun, active learning ways. So they're engaged and leave feeling empowered to do these things.
Do you ever strike up relationships with some of the young people who come, the young girls who come to these events, where maybe you kind of stay in touch?
So we have multiple girls, about 50% actually are returning girls who have come to one event before. So that means that hopefully they're having a great time and want to keep doing this. We are considering reaching out to other clubs that have more activities regularly, like Girls Who Code, so that we can plug them into these things in between our capstone events.
And what kind of support do you get from the university or from outside for these activities?
Yes. So we have funding through the Rackham Graduate School and Life Sciences Institute, but we are always looking for funding from outside sources as well as organizations that we can collaborate with, because much of this is completely, it's a nonprofit, right? So we're all volunteering our time and money, and often alumni donate quite a bit as well.
What kind of sense do you have of how these activities affect the girls who come to these capstone events and you get to see faces that return, mm-hmm. so you know you've kind of hooked them?
Yeah.
What kind of sense do you have as far as lasting impact?
So when I first volunteered with FEMS, I was a activity coordinator taking the girls around from activity to activity, and they would all say, this is so cool, I love this. They were so excited about what they were learning about, and we actually have started collecting data as well to look at their enthusiasm and empowerment or beliefs that they can pursue science themselves. So we have them do a pre-survey and a post-survey, and we've found that there's anywhere from a 15% to 25% increase in their agreement with the idea that they can pursue STEM careers or are interested in going to college and pursue STEM.
Do you have a sense, Hillary, that overall there's higher visibility, maybe greater credibility, more opportunity given to women in science now as opposed to when you came in as an undergrad?
Oh, it's night and day. So it's been a decade since I started undergraduate. That feels like a long time ago. And throughout my undergraduate and graduate career, I have made sure that I've stayed active in volunteering and reaching out to younger scientists. But my original cohort was maybe 30% women, and by the time I entered grad school, it's 50-50. We have 50% women in the biomedical sciences now. So companies or industries complaining that there aren't women pursuing science haven't looked around, because we are certainly training women to perform these tasks.
How would someone find out about the future events that FEMS is going to have?
Yes. If you Google FEMS, F-E-M-M-E-S, and UMich, U-M-I-C-H, you should find our website, and you can also email us at umich.fems@gmail.com.
All right. Well, best of luck with your PhD work, and also continuing to kind of spread the word amongst the 4th through 6th grade girls of Southeast Michigan. Hillary Miller, thank you for being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Mid-Michigan, particularly the greater Lansing area, has long been a landing spot for refugees. Before we dive into why this is so, let's hear from a couple of people who came here to build new lives for themselves and for their families. This piece is part of a conversation we had while taping at Michigan State University's campus the evening of November 2nd.
I'm Hussein Jassim. I live in Lansing, and I'm originally from Iraq. I'm 18 years old, so my impressions were, like, really scary at first. Didn't speak the language, so it was really hard.
I'm Faiza Daoud. I'm from Iraq. I live in Lansing. It was scared, not about me. I was scared about my children, because it's different than our country, different culture, language. I was scared about my family, but after that, people help us, and school is good. After that, no, I'm not scared.
Like, after meeting new people and helping through, like, the refugee services and the Arabic people here too, to help us, like, feel more comfortable here. When we were in Syria coming to here, from what we heard, is really hard to adapt, is really hard to do everything, but there's a lot of people that help out. It's not as hard as we thought to adapt to the whole new culture and everything. Now I feel like Lansing is my home. I don't feel different anymore, and I feel way more comfortable. No more barriers, like the language and social barriers and all that stuff. We don't have those anymore. So we feel a lot comfortable now.
My name is Mo Israel. I am from Burma. I'm the owner of the Naimyama Family Restaurant. Lansing is very peaceful and quiet. So I moved from Boston. The rent cheap, so the Boston very expensive. I have not enough money. So I want to start small my family business in here. One thing that good for my kids, their future, good education. So we have to survive for them, their future. All refugees come from, everybody have talents, you know. What we got experience, we can prove the United States, because this is our country. Now we are the American citizen. We want to improve our United States. So my wife, she got a dream, so she want to make the restaurant. So now we did it. Now we are very happy in Lansing, because everybody know our restaurant, our family. Everybody love our family, our restaurant. So we are so happy. This dream come true.
Those voices you just heard are among the dozen people featured in a traveling storytelling exhibit and a book called Refuge Lansing, Stories of Resettlement in Mid-Michigan. Photographer Jeremy Hrulicek came up with this idea, and he is here with us now. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And we also welcome Erica Binion. Erica is executive director of the Refugee Development Center, a grassroots Lansing group that supports refugees. Erica, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Erica, why is it that Lansing is such a landing spot for so many refugees from all over the world?
Lansing has a long history of welcoming refugees, and it's really a safe place to settle. You just heard it on those stories from Mo and from Hussein and from Faiza. This is a place where you can really build a life, build a business, buy homes. These are people who really settle here and build roots. And Lansing welcomes about 600 refugees every single year into our community for the last 2 decades. So they have become part of the fabric of this community and really have built lives here and are just part of our city.
So you've got hundreds of people who really have become part of the fabric of the city. Are there certain countries from which more people come than others?
Yeah, Lansing is a very diverse city when it comes to welcoming refugees. So we see people over the last, I've been with the Refugee Development Center for 10 years, and over those 10 years, we've seen people from the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Burma, Bhutan, all over the world that we welcome refugees from here.
Jeremy, what inspired you to come up with Refuge Lansing?
Well, like all good stories, it started with a party. Back in December, Lansing is blessed to have a large community of creative people, of artists and photographers and writers and musicians. And back in December, I hosted a party at my house on the east side with a bunch of photographers. And there's a little bit of political angst in the air after the election, and we were all sort of frustrated about what we could do to make a difference in the world. And then we realized that we're storytellers. And so we sort of banded together and recruited a group of 24 writers and photographers and designers to tell stories. And we chose to tell stories about refugees. The current political climate has sort of an us versus them feeling when it comes to immigrants and refugees in this country. And we wanted to change that conversation to a we are them conversation. Because this is a country based on immigration.
And what are the components of your program?
Well, it started small and it grew huge, and what we have now is a traveling exhibit of 12 different refugee stories, photographs and words. We have a website, refugelansing.us, and we actually crowdfunded $8,000 to print the exhibit and to print books, big, beautiful art books with all the photographs and stories. And we're selling them to raise money. All the funds go towards the four refugee resettlement agencies in Lansing.
And you wanted to focus, I understand, less on the story of how these refugees got here and more on what they have done since settling here. Why did you make that choice?
Well, refugees add so much to our communities, right? They buy homes, they start businesses, they support the local schools. I mean, it's a celebration of what refugees bring to our communities.
So tell us about one of these families, where they came from, why they came to Michigan, and what they've done since setting down roots here.
Well, I think it's great to start with Mo and his family, who we just heard. I mean, he came from Myanmar, and he was, let's see, if I remember correctly, Erica, he was a refugee from Burma.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and he was in Malaysia for a long time, working at a restaurant, and finally was given refugee status and came with his family to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And ended up starting a restaurant in Lansing, right? So he had these sort of entrepreneurial roots. And this restaurant has become famous in Lansing. It's great. It's Burmese, Thai, and Malaysian food, and it's crazy spicy, even if you order mild, right? Like, it's one of those types of places. He just recently had the privilege to go home for the first time back to Myanmar with his family for a few months, and everyone was in a panic, who loved Nang Myanmar, the name of the restaurant. And everyone was in a panic that he was closing his restaurant. It was only closing for 3 months. And so he rest assured, he made sure everyone knew he was coming back. And when he came back, He was actually closed for an extra month or so to get permits to reopen and expand. Actually, he expanded the business. It's been so popular. And now there's lines out the door every day to get into his restaurant. Just there was so much built up demand.
This is something I bet you see over and over, Erica, that entrepreneurial spirit, that once these immigrants get here and put down roots, they're bubbling up with ideas that they want to make happen.
Absolutely, and those ideas have been in their mind for years, just waiting to begin a new life. So many people that I have the privilege and honor to work with every day, I mean, they're heroic to me. They've been through grave injustices, and here they are with a smile on their face every single day, showing up to English class every day they possibly can to make sure that their life is better for their children, too. You heard that on both stories today, that this happens all the time. Every single person I come across, their goal is to make sure that their children have a better life than they did, and they do it with building businesses, they're buying homes, they're working every day to make their life a little better.
Tell us a little how the Refugee Development Center supports these folks.
So the RDC, we've been around for 15 years, and really the goal is to help people be able to thrive in their new community. There's limited amount of support when people are resettled here, and our goal is post-resettlement. How can we help people survive? So we have English classes and after-school programs. We have a summer camp, 6 weeks in the summer, free of charge for parents, that we have 80 kids participate in. We do home visits with every new family that comes into the area to make sure that they know what resources are available. So a lot of different direct service that we provide for people to really help them build those roots and thrive here and start businesses and do the things that Mo and Faiza and Hussein were doing.
Well, you can check out the Refuge Lansing Storytelling Project. The website is refugelansing.us. Erica Binion, Jeremy Herlichek, thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Many juvenile lifers accept responsibility for the murder they committed as a teen. We heard Antonio Asprey do that just this last week on Stateside. But Fred Williams has been incarcerated for 16 years for something he says he did not do. But maintaining his innocence in court could put him at risk of never getting out. Morgan Springer from Interlochen Public Radio has Fred's story.
In March 2001, Fred Williams left his friend Tanya Davis's house to get groceries. He was 17 and living on the west side of Detroit.
And so when Tanya said that she wanted to cook spaghetti for the day, I had two options. I had hometown groceries on Joy Road in Wyoming, or I had Foodorama on Livernois and Julian.
Fred chose Foodorama because he could sell drugs there.
You know, because I can buy this ingredients for the spaghetti and make a sale at the same time.
Fred had been selling drugs for about 3 years, mostly working under someone else. Fred made a drug sale, went into the store, and got the ingredients for spaghetti.
As I'm at the counter being served by the clerk, that's when I get tackled by these detectives.
The next thing he knows, Fred's at the police station being interrogated. They're saying he murdered a 40-year-old woman named Donna Houghton. Here's what happened to Donna Houghton. On January 17, 2001, firefighters pulled her from a burning house on Joy Road. She was already dead. Not from the fire, though. She had been shot twice, once in the back, once in the head. Her roommate told police that before she jumped out her bedroom window to escape, she'd seen two men with a gun and a gas can. She heard the gunshots as she ran away from the house. Fred was held at the police station for more than a day. He kept insisting he didn't do it, but he was put in a lineup and picked out by the roommate. Then a homicide detective wrote a confession while Fred dictated.
He's writing it. At the time, I'm illiterate. I can't even write. I couldn't even write a statement at that time if I wanted to.
The confession said Fred went to Donna's house alone to collect $350 she owed him, but she said she didn't have the money, and then, quote, I started sprinkling gas around. Donna then came at me with a knife. I had a gun in my coat pocket, right pocket. I pulled it out and shot her, end quote. Fred says none of that is true. He's 34 now. He says he did go to the house a few weeks before with a friend to drop off money, but that was it. He says he gave his confession because he thought it was his best chance at a shorter prison sentence. While Fred was waiting for his trial, he called his mom. He told her he had $4,000 in savings hidden in her house, and he needed her to take that money and get him a lawyer.
And before I told her where it was at, you know, I asked her, you know, like, vow to me, promise me, you know, promise me that you're going to take this money and go do the right thing with it. Like, there's no time to play around. You know, charging me with murder, first-degree murder, talking about giving me life. And, you know, she vowed to me. She's crying, Frederick, I promise to tell me where it's at. I'm about to go do it right now. And I told her where it was at. And she went and retrieved it. And she proceeded to spend it all getting high. She spent it all paying some of the drug debts that she had and purchasing more drugs to get high.
More than a year after Fred was arrested, he went to trial with a court-appointed attorney. He was found guilty of first-degree murder and arson and given the state's mandatory sentence, life without the possibility of parole. Fred's last act in the free world was a trip to the Foodorama to buy ingredients for spaghetti. He's been in prison ever since.
24211, escort for one volunteer, please.
I met Fred at a writing workshop at Macomb Correctional Facility in 2015. He sat in a blue and orange jumpsuit in a conference room with eight other prisoners, all poets. They take turns reading something they've written. Here's part of what Fred read that day.
This is a journal entry, September 2015. Today is Mom's birthday. Sadly, I feel unaffected. Sad because I wish I could feel some sense of love for her. Of all the hardships you've put me through, I was looking forward to coming home from prison and building our relationship anew. But you died on me. But I want you to know I've changed my life in a positive way. I'm educated now. I'm drug-free. I embrace my emotions. I'm in love with a beautiful girl. I'm anti-violence. I'm a published poet. I'm friendly. Because of you, I now appreciate good parenting. The responsibility of having another human life in your hands is not to be fumbled. I miss you, Mama, but you fumbled.
Fred was transferred to Marquette Branch Prison in the Upper Peninsula recently. But after years of being told he was going to die in prison, Fred now has reason to hope. 5 years ago, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling said, giving juveniles who commit murder a mandatory life sentence is cruel and unusual punishment. Another ruling after that said Michigan and 27 other states with similar laws had to give these juvenile lifers a shot at a second chance. In Michigan, that means resentencing. Under the new rules, Fred could serve a minimum of 27 years or he could get life again. The court will look at many factors when deciding how long Fred's punishment should be. One is his upbringing, acknowledgement that juvenile lifers like Fred can be a product of an environment they didn't choose. Fred says his life got pretty serious when he was around 6 years old and his parents got addicted to crack cocaine.
While they smoked drugs, they had a sheet to cover the entrance of the kitchen. So they would be cooking drugs and selling drugs and smoking drugs in the kitchen. And we were supposed to be good little kids and sit there and watch cartoons. Well, always, sometimes my sister and I and my little brother, we would sneak around the living room until where we could see what was going on in the kitchen. And I don't know, it was a learning experience, whether people realize it or not. You're learning as a kid, whether you're learning to read, whether you're learning to play basketball, softball, or cook crack and sell crack, you're learning. And so that's what my learning experience was, drugs and violence.
When Fred was 8 or 9, his dad got pneumonia, but he still had to go out into a blizzard to sell drugs. One day he came into the house to warm up.
He sat on his little recliner, and he put his feet up. And he never woke up from there.
The next time Fred saw his dad was at his funeral. By age 14, Fred had taken the night shift on the corner, selling drugs for the same guy his dad had worked for before he died.
I sold crack, I sold heroin, I sold marijuana. I robbed people, I broke in houses, I stole cars and sold parts from cars. Yeah, I was involved in the underworld pretty heavy.
When Fred was sent to prison for life, he didn't leave the underworld. In 2009, 8 years into his incarceration, Fred stabbed another prisoner in the face with a makeshift knife during a fight and was sent to segregation for months. There, he took time to reflect.
And I'm like, man, I have to make a change. Like, I need to grow up.
He found out he could get books delivered from the library to segregation. One of the first books he requested was the Norton Reader.
And the Norton Reader encompassed instructions on how to conduct yourself as a man and how not to.
This was the beginning of Fred's evolution, rehabilitation. That's another important factor Michigan courts will consider during Fred's resentencing hearing. Fred's earned his GED. He's taken college classes. He paints and makes bracelets. And he's facilitated poetry and reading groups. Still, these accomplishments are not enough. At least that's what Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said. She's asking the court to still keep Fred in prison for life. She's basically saying Fred is irredeemable or, in legalese, irreparably corrupt. Her office declined an interview. This recommendation does not determine the resentencing outcome, but Fred's fight to get out of prison will be harder. And Fred has another problem. He'll likely do better at resentencing if he accepts responsibility for the crime. Valerie Newman is Fred's attorney. She works for the Michigan State Appellate Defender Office and has practiced law for more than 25 years.
There is a tension that people don't understand between maintaining your innocence and trying to achieve your freedom. Because maintaining his innocence is at odds with what the courts and the prosecutor want, which is acceptance of responsibility as a sign of rehabilitation and growth and maturity.
Valerie says Fred has a tortured choice to make. He can say he killed Donna, show remorse, and hope for a reduced prison sentence, or he can maintain his innocence and risk staying in prison for life. This is a strategic decision most juvenile lifers do not face because they've admitted their guilt.
You know, so it's not an easy decision to make, especially in a case like this where, you know, we don't know that we're going to be able to prove it at this stage. And it's something that Fred and I have discussed at length about his case.
Right. And she said she told me out of her own mouth, like, it's ultimately my decision, which course I wanted to take, you know. And, you know, everyone says it's the best thing for me to do is, you know, just like swallow the pill and take the juvenile life route. But I don't want to.
Like, who's saying that to you?
Everybody. I mean, all of my friends in here, like, we have these conversations because we talk about each other's cases and appeals and going home. And, like, all of the guys here, you know, like, we're seeing juvenile lifers go home. And so the guys are like, man, you know, we may point someone out who's in a wheelchair who's been in here for 50 years filing appeals, trying to wait on an appeal. And it's kind of like, do you want to be the guy who's going home, or do you want to be the guy who's here in the wheelchair 50 years later, still saying he's innocent? And I'm like, I don't know if that guy's innocent or not, but I know where I was, and I know what I didn't do. But honestly, I don't want to get up. I don't want to get up there and say I did it. I don't want to get up there and take responsibility for it because it means a lot to me, man. Like to murder a woman over $350, to be a part of murdering someone and setting them on fire. That's not like I've done some things. Like I'm not a choir boy. I'm not, you know, I'm not an angel or anything. But like that's not who I am. That's not me. I didn't do it, and so I shouldn't have to say that I did it just to get out of prison.
There are two main pieces of evidence against Fred. There's his confession of guilt, and there's the eyewitness identification by the roommate, Yolanda Trotter. In both cases, there are questions about how valid the evidence is. For one, Trotter says when the cops called her to come see Fred's lineup, they told her they had the guy. Eve Primus is a professor at University of Michigan Law School.
If the police suggest to the witness that they've caught the guy, it puts pressure on the witness to pick that person or to pick a person out of whatever lineup or identification procedure the police show the individual. So it absolutely is a problematic procedure to employ.
A Detroit Police Department spokesman declined comment for this story, but in trial transcripts, the police officer denies telling Trotter the main suspect was in the lineup. Another problem is Yolanda Trotter picked someone else out of the lineup first, not Fred. And then she picked Fred. She says that's because she was nervous. She told me this summer, quote, "Fred is guilty as sin. He's saying what he's saying. I'm saying what I know." I asked her, "Do you have any shadow of a doubt?" She said, "I am 98.9% sure." Then there's Fred's confession. First of all, the facts in it don't quite match up with the evidence. On top of that, Fred's claiming the confession was made up. Professor Primus says that does happen.
It's actually much more plausible than people realize. In the studies of exonerations based on DNA evidence, in the first 250 exonerations, 40 of those individuals had falsely confessed.
The National Registry of Exonerations makes a similar point. Fred's juvenile resentencing hearing is not yet scheduled. His best case scenario, he'd get the minimum sentence and serve 11 more years in prison. But he'd still be a convicted felon.
I'll take it. I'm not going to be foolish, but that's not what I want. It's not how I want to come home. It's not. I want to be vindicated.
And there is a chance Fred could be vindicated. He has one other legal option. In addition to the juvenile resentencing, his attorney can open a completely separate innocence case. They need new, compelling evidence to do that. And this summer, his attorney, Valerie Newman, says she found something. She says she thinks they've solved the crime, but she still needs more details for a strong innocence case. Fred's childhood friend, Chantel, told him once, "Even though you're in prison, you're doing better than most of the men from our neighborhood."
Man, it's hard to imagine what I would have become had I not came to prison. It's hard to imagine what situation I would be in, whether I would even be alive. My everyday company, man, no one has been successful. And I don't even mean material success. I just mean like a peaceful state. Everyone who I know who I was with on a daily basis are in prison or dead or hiding from police or running from police, still living in the world of crime. It makes me want to say yes, that I was better off coming to prison. But I hate prison so strongly. I have such a strong disdain for prison that I just can't allow myself to say it.
That story was produced by Morgan Springer. It was edited by Peter Payette with help from Rod Rosenthal and Bob Campbell. The story is part of Interlochen Public Radio's series Irredeemable, about Michigan juvenile lifers. To hear more stories in this series, just go to irredeemable.org. I've got an invitation to you. Join me tonight at the Clada Irish Pub at the Eastwood Town Center in Lansing. In case you haven't heard, I am leading a group of Michigan radio adventurers on a trip to Ireland next June. It all benefits Michigan radio and the programs like Stateside that you rely on. Tonight at 7, we're having an information session to tell you all about our Ireland adventure. In a nutshell, we'll be starting in Dublin and then head to Waterford, on through Cork to Killarney, heading up to Limerick, where we'll explore the west coast of Clare and beautiful Galway, and then back east, where we spend our last night on the grounds of a beautiful Irish castle. Yes, beautiful is the operative word. I've been traveling to Ireland since going there for school in 1973, so I've lost count of the trips I've made. I married a Cork man, and I cannot wait to show my second homeland to Michigan radio listeners. Again, Clada Irish Pub at the Eastwood Town Center, Lake Lansing Road at 127. It's at 7 tonight, and if you can't make tonight's session, not to worry. We've got details for you at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our engineer was Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Danny Hensel, Sarah Leeson, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.